Monday the 2nd of July, Rabbi Yehuda Landi, Tanakh versus Archaeology.
Good morning, everyone. Just like to mention that today's shiur is Yehuda Nishmas, Rabbi Yoel Ben Avraham Alevi of Yoel Chagas today. Truth is, when I was asked to speak, I had an idea to speak about Tanakh versus Archaeology, but I realized that for many people this is their Torah shiur that they begin the day with, and it comes at an expense of another Torah shiur that would be otherwise, and therefore I feel compelled. I will speak about Torah versus archaeology, but I feel compelled to speak about certain chidushim or certain enlightenments that I got in understanding Gemara or Chazal in light of archaeology, and we will tie in, of course, the whole story, and also tie it into the story of the Churban Beis Hamikdash, the 3 weeks which are coming up. But in the days of the first Beis Hamikdash, the walls of Yerushalayim were breached on the 9th of Tammuz, not on the 17th. So we're already in the heart of the 3 weeks from the Churban of the first Beis Hamikdash. As a matter of fact, it's very interesting Yerushalmi. The Mishnah says that the Beis Hamikdash was destroyed, and the first Beis Hamikdash and the second were both destroyed on Tisha B'Av. And there's one opinion in Yerushalmi that the first Beis Hamikdash was actually destroyed on Rosh Chodesh Av. And why? Because it's a 3-week process, and if the wall was breached on the ninth of Tammuz, so then the destruction is actually on the Rosh Chodesh Av. And that fits in with the first vision that Yirmiyahu HaNavi sees, that we're reading the Haftarah this week. Hashem shows him Makel Shoked, a branch of a tree from an almond tree. And Chazal said that the almond tree, the blossoming process takes 3 weeks. So again, if the breaching of the walls of Yerushalayim were on the 9th of Tammuz, so then the destruction of first Beis Hamikdash, one opinion in the Yerushalmi, now like the Mishnah, is that it actually took place on Rosh Chodesh. Okay, we speak about archaeology versus Tanakh. I start off with a brief story. A friend of mine had a teenage son growing up in New York, a little mischievous, and one time he was walking down the street in New York, and it happens to be December 25th, and TV news stations got to make news, so they go around stopping Jews on the street and asking them how they react to this holiday, which is not theirs. How do they survive? How do they react to it living in New York when this holiday comes around? And most of the people said, you know, it's not our holiday, it's a regular day to us, and go on. But they come to this kid, and the kid thinks for 2 seconds and says to himself, if I would say the usual, so I'll be one of 1,000 people, and big deal. But if I say something sensational, I'll be the one that's going to appear on the news tonight. So he makes up, fabricates a whole story about how he, whatever, doesn't matter what he said, but makes up, fabricates a whole interesting story. And sure enough, that night he's the one who was shown when on the interview, he was the one who was shown. What am I saying? I'm saying, you know, when they produce news, news has got to be sensational. If something is the ordinary, so you don't make it to the news. Very often, when it comes to archaeology and Tanakh, you hear the news, you hear the people get up who deny the Tanakh, and they say there's no evidence connecting between archaeology and Tanakh, and they get the headlines. But the truth of the matter is that there's plenty of evidence out there, and there's plenty of archaeologists who believe in the connection between archaeology and Tanakh. But they don't get the headlines, because that's not news. That's old stuff. The new stuff is the person who can detach it, he gets the news. In truth, we have to understand, and as I said, I'm going to try to be brief on this because I really want to get the focus to Divrei Torah and a little about the halachic aspect of archaeology and what it teaches us. In truth, it's like this. You walk around major empires like the Assyrian Empire, the Egyptian Empire, the Roman Empire, the Greek Empire. You see the remains of all these massive buildings, etc. When you go to Yerushalayim, we don't really see that much from the time of the first Beis HaMikdash. We don't see much of Shlomo HaMelech's Beis HaMikdash. We don't see much of the Commonwealth. So people tend to draw a quick conclusion. If we don't see it, how come we don't see it compared to other places where we do see it? So it must have not existed. Okay, archaeology, which is a relatively new field and far from being an exact science, exists for 100, 150 years. It's always changing. It's... as I said, not an exact science. It's always advancing itself and analyzing the stuff. So when you have massive structures, they speak for themselves. But sometimes you have small, tiny things over there which can tell a greater story, but you don't see it right away. It takes time until you're able to pull the stuff out. One of the things that commonly is raised again is the issue of Malchus Beis David. How come we don't have any traces from David HaMelech? And as I said, massive construction in Yerushalayim from the time of David HaMelech, etc., we do not find. So the truth of the matter is, of Yerushalayim HaKodesh, the old city from the days of David HaMelech, very little has been excavated, and the reason is because very little has survived. When the Romans ruled over the country after the Churban Second Beis HaMikdash, they pretty much used that area, which is known today as Ir David. They flattened the area, they used it as a quarry, they used it to cut out rocks, so very little of it surviving. Of all that's excavated in Ir David, and I assume that some of you have been there, 2-3 hour tour in Ir David, that's all, maybe about 10% of the entire Ir David, but very little of it is actually surviving today, so it's very hard to know what was there. Another point is, when you have a civilization that continues for hundreds of years, it's very hard to find remains of the beginning of the civilization. If the civilization reaches an abrupt end, such as a destruction, that'll be found very easily. But if the civilization lasts for 400 or 500 years, you'll only find the last 100-150 years. So finding David HaMelech in archaeology, finding Shlomo is very difficult. The Beis HaMikdash, of course, the Har HaBayis, very little, if any, survives. Excavations over there are impossible. The king's palace, which Shlomo HaMelech built, is on the southern, today on the southern part of Har HaBayis, because Hardus, when he rebuilt the second base of English, he expanded the Har HaBayis and he covered that area also. So therefore, it's impossible to excavate, and probably none of it remains either, because when Hardus built, he cut everything off. So if we want to find clues to Shlomo HaMelech, etc., we're going to have to find it in a different way, not in the common way, for example, that people that we find in other kingdoms, massive palaces like Assyrian palaces or Egyptian structures, etc. As I said, I want to tie it into the Churban, and I want to give the Beit Torah, so therefore I choose to go to this example. There's a site in the Sinai Desert which is called Kuntilat Adjrud. This site was excavated by the Israelis when they controlled the Sinai Desert. It's in southern Sinai, and it's a site that was only in use for a short time. It was probably a stopover for travelers heading down towards the port of Eilat. It was in use for a short time, and after that it was abandoned. And the finds over there are very interesting. Because, for example, they found a bunch of textiles. Textiles are very rarely found in Eretz Yisrael because organic material rots away. In Egypt, you have lots of textiles, but in Mesopotamia, in Assyria, pretty much none. In Eretz Yisrael, the only places where textiles survived are along the Dead Sea, the Jordan Valley. But other than that, pretty much none to speak of from the days of the first Beis HaMikdash. And this site over here, which is in the Sinai Desert, they found a bunch of textiles, including one piece which was chatnez, wool and linen. Got to be discussed in itself, what's the significance of it, but it's interesting in itself. What happens is that besides finding textiles over there, they found large jars, storage jars, and on it were markings, Hebrew markings. The archaeologists, when they find such a thing, the first thing is they want to know who it dates to, etc. How can we, where it comes from, where this marking from, where is this place from? And the archaeologist comes to the conclusion that the only place where there are such markings have been found in Yerushalayim. That's the only place. But consider that from Yerushalayim all the way down to the southern Sinai, we're talking about a major distance. So the question is, did these things come from Yerushalayim or not? And in today's modern science, there are ways to prove it. And the way, when you have pottery, by the way, the dating on pottery is usually, it's not an organic material. We cannot do any carbon dating on it. The only dating system is that we look at the type of pottery, and we know that in a certain period, they use this type of pottery. That, of course, is not an exact dating system. That can be 25 years, that can be 100 years. It'll give us a general figure, but not an exact figure. But one thing today that could be done, very interestingly, is what's called neutron analysis tests. You can take the piece of pottery and grind it up and send it to some nuclear labs, etc., for analysis, for the neutron analysis. And it seems that every spot on the Earth has a different chemical composition of the clay. So when you put it in to the test, you can, after testing out the whole, after knowing the chemical composition of the entire country, we can know where the clay came from originally. So even if I find a piece of pottery here, I can look at it and test it and say, although this was found here, but it originated somewhere else. To give you an example from the Gemara in Shabbos talks about clay Kfar Shichin and clay Kfar Hananya. Gemara Masechah Shabbos. Kfar Shichin and Kfar Hananya are two places in the Galil, and from there they manufactured clay cheres pottery, the best pottery which was. It turns out that 50% of the pottery found in the Galil area came from Kfar Hananya. Today, tested from in the Galil area from the time of the Mishnah, 50% came from Kfar Hananya. Not only that, but when they wanted to find the furnace where in Kfar Hananya they actually manufactured these vessels, they used this neutron analysis test to see where in Kfar Hananya came from, and that's how they were able to locate the furnace where it was actually manufactured. So the science is pretty much, you can say, an exact science. I can say that some archaeologists, that I spoke to one doctor at Hebrew University who's in charge of this, not Jewish, he's by the name of Jan Gunawag, and he told me that he makes himself a lot of enemies. Why does he make himself a lot of enemies? Because a lot of archaeologists have to rewrite the book after these things are tested. Because archaeology, again, is a lot of logic and theory, but everyone knows that it changes over the time, and these people don't like his conclusions, so he creates himself a lot of enemies. That's what he told me. Anyway, back to our story. They took these pieces of pottery from Kuntilat HaDruid in the Sinai Desert and sent them for neutron analysis tests. There are a couple tests that could be done, and the conclusion is that indeed these large storage jars came from Yerushalayim. Now this is a fascinating point, because that would mean for someone to take large storage jars, which were probably shipped full with provisions to this traveling spot along the Sinai, can only indicate a powerful king who's sitting in Yerushalayim, who's controlling the entire Negev in the south to Eilat, who has a lot of commerce traveling back and forth, and he can send provisions from Yerushalayim all the way to this place. Truth of the matter is, there are only two possible kings in the history of Melachim who could be in charge, who can be responsible for sending the stuff, and one of them could be Shlomo HaMelech. The other possibility is King Uzziyahu, who also controlled the area, and we know that he built stuff in the desert, although the likelihood of King Uzziyahu, the archaeologists told me probably not, because it's probably before Uzziyahu. Is it in the time of Shlomo? That's very complex, because when we go in the dating system and we want to know when Shlomo HaMelech lived, very briefly I'll tell you that the Persian era and Chazal and the scientific chronology differ greatly in the difference of 165 years, which means, according to Chazal, the Persian Empire in the days of the Second Beis HaMikdash lasted only 34 to 40 years, while according to the scientific chronology, it lasted for 165 years. So, if you're looking for Shlomo HaMelech, it depends when you're looking for him. According to the scientific chronology, he should be in what's known as the 10th century BCE. If you're looking according to Chazal's chronology, then you have to 150 years later. And that pretty much does match the time of the food that was found in Kuntilat HaDruid. So Kuntilat HaDruid can be that missing link, people looking for the empire of Shlomo HaMelech, where he controlled massive areas. You're not going to find much in Yerushalayim. It was built, destroyed, etc. But a place that served only for a short time, such as Kuntilat HaDruid, can supply the answer. How does that tie into our Torah thing? So what's interesting is, Kuntilat HaDruid is clearly a Jewish site. I didn't tell you yet how I know it's Jewish. What's Jewish about it is that they found inscriptions over there, including besides inscriptions on pottery, which are pretty much the only inscriptions from the first Beis HaMikdash we have, they even found inscriptions written on wall plaster. Now, we know, for example, the Mizbech and Arevo, the Torah was written on plaster, and mentioned another important find that has to do with last week's Parsha, Bilam and Balak, they found a Nevuah in Jordan, on a site called Der Allah, which is a city of Sukkos in Jordan. They found on wall plaster an inscription from the end of the first Beis Hamikdash period. On it, it had a nevuah from none other than Bilam ben Bar. It mentions Bilam by name four times. It refers to him Ish Chose Elokim. He's a person who sees visions from Hashem, which is very similar to what we have in Chumash. Hashem Machazeh Shakai Yechazeh. He sees visions. It's not the same nevuah that's in Ahav Asha, but it mentions the same person, Bilam ben Bar, which is a fascinating find in itself. Currently, today is can be seen in the museum in Amman, Jordan. I didn't make it that far. I was in Jordan, but Amman I stayed away from. But it's there. I was in Tel Sukkot, but it's there. It can be seen. Okay. So in Kuntilat HaJud, back to the site that we're focusing on now, they found. So that was also written on plaster, which was on a wall. And in Kuntilat HaJud, they found pieces of pottery, and some of them have Hashem's name on it. Not only pottery, but like there was a bed or something like that, which a utensil which had Hashem's name on it. Yud Kei Vav Kei, Hashem's name. We have in the Gemara in Erchin that if Hashem's name is written on the leg of a bed, then you cut it off, etc. So the concept to have Hashem's name on a utensil on a household furniture is found in our sources. So that was found over there. That's one. And they also found over there a shard of pottery which had the olive base on it four times. Four times, Aleph, Beis, Gimel, Dalet, everything is right. Except that this author made one small mistake. As he's practicing to write Aleph, Beis, he made one small mistake, and four times in a row, he put the pei before the ayin. Everything else was in order, except the pei before the ayin. Now this piece of pottery is on display in the Israel Museum. Unfortunately, in the last couple of years, Israel gave back all the finds from Sinai to Egypt. That was part of the peace agreement with Egypt. The stuff was supposed to come back on loan. So far it hasn't, but that was maybe one day it will. There are two sites in Sinai which are definitely Jewish sites, which are under Egyptian control. One of them is Kadesh Barnea, which talks of where the Meraglim was sent from, and the second is this site of Kuntilat HaJud, clearly Jewish sites. And so this piece of pottery. Now, what do you think? That the sofa made a mistake four times? He made the same mistake? Well, of course, if he copied from the wrong place, so then he made the mistake four times. Possible. But it's definitely not a coincidence. And we have a similar case like that in the Gemara in Sanhedrin and Daf Kuf Dalet. The Gemara says like this. Pocho laich p'em, amar rav amar v'yachonon, v'shul ma'ek dim pei la'ayin. So let's give a little introduction. Eicha, coming up on Tisha B'Av, hopefully this year we shall be celebrating Tisha B'Av, we won't have to read Eicha. But Eicha, written by Yirmiyahu Navi, is written in a very interesting format. Prakim, Aleph, Beis, and Dalet are written in alphabetical order. The first pasuk, Eicha, starts with an Aleph. The second pasuk, Bachosif Kebalaila, starts with a Beis. And the third pasuk, Gimel, Golso, Yehuda Meoni, Dalet, Dachet, and Avelos. That's how the whole order of Sefer Eicha is written. Perek Aleph, Beis, and Dalet are all in alphabetical order. Perek Gimel is in triple alphabetical order, which means the first three psukim begin with an Aleph, the second three psukim begin with a Beis, etc. The only perek that is not in alphabetical order is the last perek, Perek Hei. But what's interesting is that in Prakim, Beis, Gimel, and Dalet, the pasuk beginning with the Pei comes before the pasuk beginning with the Ayin. In Perek Aleph, it's in the regular order that we have, but Perek Beis, Gimel, and Dalet, it's in Pei before the Ayin. So the Gemara discusses this already over here. Amar Rav Amar Biyachonam, Sanhedrin Kuf Dalet Amar Beis. Bishvil Ma Hikdim Pei La'ayin, why did Yirmiyahu put the pasuk of Pei, Patro Laich Piyam, before the pasuk of Ayin? Bishvil Meraglim, Sh'amur Vifiyam, Ashalor Ro Beinem. Chazal tie in, as we all know, the Chet HaMeraglim is one of the things that happened on Tisha B'Av, and Yirmiyahu HaNavi ties in the Churban too. We know the Gemara says that Hashem told them, you cried on Tisha B'Av, and the Meraglim came back, you cried B'chir Shel Chinam, you cried for no valid purpose, V'ani Yekvah Lachem B'chir L'doros, I will set up a B'chir for generations. So, saying the Meraglim, they said B'fihem, they said with their mouth, Mashallah Ro Beinem, what they didn't see with their eyes. Now, in ancient Hebrew script, not the script that we use today, the Ksav Ashuri, the Ksav Ivri, the ancient Hebrew script, the symbols represent the sound that you're supposed to say. So, for example, the Dalet originated as the form of a fish, So you remember that it's a Dalet. And we know today the ancient Hebrew script. Maybe time permitting, we'll talk a little more about that. The Pei represents the mouth, and the Ayin is round and represents the eye. So the Gemara says, why does the Pei come before the Ayin? Because of the Chet HaMeraglim, who said with their mouth what they didn't see with their eyes. So the Pei comes before the Ayin. So this is a very nice Gemara, and I'm walking to the Israel Museum, I'm saying, this is very interesting. That's very nice. But what I do with this piece of pottery here that has the Pei before the Ayin four times, could it have been from the time of the Yirmiyahu? The answer is no, it's before Yirmiyahu. And I call up this professor, who's considered the top expert on ancient Hebrew writing, Yosef Naveh, and he tells me, indeed, there was an Aleph Beis where the Pei comes before the Ayin, and the pottery at Kuntilat HaDruid is not unique. He mentioned to me another place near Tel Aviv, which also a piece of pottery was found from the time of the Shoftim, and also the Pei comes before the Ayin. So I draw the inevitable conclusion that there definitely was a form of Aleph Beis where the Pei comes before the Ayin. We see it. But wait a second, but what do we do with the Gemara? The Gemara says that the reason why Yirmiyahu does it is because he wanted to show a certain message. So, I will ask a question. Why didn't Yirmiyahu HaNavi do this order in the first parak also? How come in the first parak, Yirmiyahu HaNavi went in the proper order, the ayin before the pay, comes to the second parak, he puts the pay before the ayin? So the Marsha already asked a question. And the Masha suggests an interesting answer. He says, if Yirmiyahu HaNavi would have put everything in, even the first parak, to pay before the Ayin, so then you would have thought that Yirmiyahu HaNavi had a different order in the office. But Yirmiyahu HaNavi wanted to show you that he has a normal order, and for that reason, in the first parak, it's in the normal order. Second, third, and fourth, he switched. So there's our answer. It's true, Yirmiyahu HaNavi didn't invent a new system which didn't exist. In other words, he could have, for whatever reason, switched the hay and the vav if he had some significance to do it. But he didn't do that. He switched the pay and the ayin. Did he know the proper order? He knew the proper order. In the first parak, the order is proper. But when it comes to he wanted to show the point, but he used to show the point a system which had existed beforehand. He didn't invent a new system. The system of the pay before the ayin, as we clearly see in archaeology, existed beforehand, and Yirmiyahu just used it over here, even though that's not the order used today, but he used it here to bring out that particular point to show the Chet HaMeraglim. Since we spoke about the pay and the ayin, so I will tell you a very interesting story which you find in the Ramban. Often I'm asked, am I wasting time studying the archaeology? Getting into this, I don't have a straight answer for this. I don't necessarily recommend everyone to do what I do, but as I said, sometimes the things I get out are very interesting things that we learn and understand. If I can just mention a quick point before I get to start with the Ramban, an interesting point is we know that the second Beis HaMikdash was inaugurated in Sefer Ezra on the 3rd of Adar. It doesn't mention why the 3rd of Adar. The 3rd of Adar seems to be a significant day, but why? Because later on, when King Herdus inaugurates his Beis HaMikdash, he rebuilt the second Beis HaMikdash. When he inaugurates it, it's again the 3rd of Adar. So the 3rd of Adar seems to be significant, but we don't know why. I think I may have discovered the answer. There's a tablet in the British Museum which talks about Golas Babel. Now, when the Babylonians captured Eretz Yisrael, the Churban was in the days of King Tzidkiyahu. But 11 years before that, King Yechoniah was taken into Golos by Nebuchadnezzar. Yechoniah was the king before Tzidkiyahu, and Nebuchadnezzar at first captured Yerushalayim and didn't destroy the Beis HaMikdash. Yechoniah went out on his own accord, or whether he was plotted to go out, but he went out and he went to Babel with the elite of Klal Yisrael, and there in Babel 11 years before the Beis HaMikdash is destroyed. Yechezkel is saying Nebuah in Babel during those years. The elite Chazal say they set up the Torah center in Babel, so when the rest of the Jews went into Golos, the Torah was, centers were already set up, so that's how Torah can survive. So this tablet in the British Museum is not talking about the Churban. We don't have a chronology of Nebuchadnezzar's activities during the years of the Churban, but this is a tablet talking about his activities in the earlier years. And when it comes to the eighth year, which is the year of Golos Yechoniah, it mentions that Nebuchadnezzar came to the city of Judah, which is probably Yerushalayim. He took the king and lots of spoils and brought it to Babel and appointed a new king. What's interesting is that it mentions the dates of the siege of Yerushalayim, and the date begins in the month of Kislev and ended on the second day of Adar. It's a three-month siege, very brief compared to the year-and-a-half siege when the Beis HaMikdash was destroyed, probably because Yechoniah went out on his own accord, or Yechoniah was sent out, but Nebuchadnezzar accepted that. But anyway, we see from this interesting date, the second of Adar is when Yerushalayim was captured. So the goals of Yechoniah, safe to presume, is around the third of Adar. According to the Gemara in Megillah, the calculation of when the 70 years of Golos Babel had to begin was thought to begin from Golos Yechoniah. Later on, they realized that it's actually from the Churban of the Beis HaMikdash. Gemara in Megillah in the first parak. So perhaps the third of Adar is actually like considered the beginning of the Golos, and that's what was significant when they inaugurated the second Beis HaMikdash. Okay, I promise you a story with the Ramban. Very interesting story. The Ramban came to Eretz Yisrael around the year 1270 L'minyanam, and in his parish on the Torah, he changed a few things when he got to Eretz Yisrael and he saw the situation. One of them, for example, is the understanding of where Kevar Rachel is. The pasuk says Kevar Rachel is Vod Kivras Eretz Bavar Frasa. Rashi alone has four different explanations for the word Kivras Eretz. When the Ramban comes to Eretz Yisrael, he says, now I've been here, I've seen it, it's so close to Beit Lechem, I know exactly what Kivras Eretz means. Another interesting thing which has been printed in the back of the Ramban in the Rav Chavel's edition, it was printed earlier also, he didn't invent it, is a story that the Ramban comes to Akko. And in Akko, he's presented a coin. And he looks at the coin, and he couldn't read it. And the reason why he couldn't read it was because it was written in ancient Hebrew script. And the Ramban couldn't read it. But there are people who do read it. And who are they? The Kusim, the Samaritans, the Gemara says in Masechet Sanhedrin, they still use the ancient Hebrew script. The Samaritans are still around. There are about 600 of them. They're storing themselves, not for today. Did some research on them too. The Ramban finds his coin, and he describes the coin, and he says it very nicely done, and I couldn't read it, and I gave it to the Samaritan. The Samaritan read it. On one side it said, Shekel Hashkalim, and on the other side it says, Yerushalayim HaKadosha. By the way, do I have a replica? I have a replica afterwards if anyone would like to see. Shekel Hashkalim and Yerushalayim HaKadosha. So Ramban says to himself, wow, this is an authentic shekel from the days of the Beis HaMikdash. What was the first thing that the Ramban went to do? He took the coin to weigh it. Why did he weigh it? Because practical application. There's one mitzvah that depends today on the weight of the shekel, and that is the mitzvah of Fidyon HaBen. Now, machtzis shekel is a minute. We don't give the weight of the original shekel, but Fidyon HaBen, we have to give the weight of the original shekel. Now, the two opinions is Rashi and the Gaonim, and there's two opinions what the weight of the shekel is. And the Ramban originally started with the Gaonim, but when the Ramban took the coin and he weighed it, he saw that it weighed like Rashi, and the Ramban accepted the archaeological evidence and accepted that the proper weight of the shekel is Rashi's opinion and not the Ramban, and not the Gaonim, sorry. The Ramban does try to reconcile the two, and based on the Gemara in Bechoros, that the Gemara says that during the days of the second Beis HaMikdash, they added 20% to the shekel. So perhaps the shekel that he got is an old shekel, and maybe afterwards they added 20%, and therefore the Gaonim are right, and they have the larger shekel. Today with archaeology we can safely say stone weights have been found from the days of the first Beis HaMikdash, and they weigh 11.22 grams. The shekel that the Ramban had, which we have, which fits the description, which I'll tell you in a moment, is clearly the new shekel, because it weighs 14 point something grams. In other words, it already has the 20% added. It's a late shekel. The Ramban, of course, had no way of knowing this, but the shekel that he saw was the coin that was minted at the end of the second Beis HaMikdash when the Jews revolted against the Romans. So it was a very late shekel. It's the new shekel which already has the extra 20% on. Many times I take people to the British Museum and I show them the weights on the first Beis HaMikdash and I show them the shekel from the second, 20% more, as the Gemara says. People are kind of amazed. There's nothing to be amazed. I mean, when the Gemara says it, when the Mishnah says it, it was reality and clear to them. Anyway, the Ramban describes the coin, and he says on the front of it, the Kusim Sei is a jar of the Tzinsenes Haman, and on the back of it is the staff of Aaron with the blossoming almonds, which in Parshas Korach. Today's Talmudim believe that that's not exactly the symbols that are on the coin, but clearly we know the coin that the Ramban had, as I said, it weighs 14 point something grams, which would mean that for Pidgin Aben, 5 of them is about 75 grams. Today, Mumachmer, 100 grams of silver, I'm not Paschkeing Lemaisa, but I'm bringing an example of where the Ramban accepted archaeological evidence into Halacha. That's an issue that's discussed to this very day, the question the size of the Kazayas. Are the Kazayasim today the same as they were then, or are they different, which is already a lot discussed in the Achronim. Research today has shown that the Kazayasim in Eretz Yisrael are pretty much the same size as those from the days of the Beis HaMikdash. They found some, etc. The problem with these sizes will not come from, the solution to the problem of the difference in sizes will not come from the archaeology, because the sizes are the same. But anyway, all told, there definitely are lots of archaeological evidence which is direct from the Tanakh, and is the stuff which correlates with the Tanakh. In most cases, it usually depends on the opinion of the archaeologist himself or the scholar himself, and his personal opinion will actually dictate what his conclusions are. Everyone's biased, but I'm saying, you know, people come in the name of science. We have to know that in reality, there's plenty of stuff out there. Even those who deny some of the stuff, they can't deny that there's plenty of stuff out there, the Malchai Ashur, Malchai Bavel, Paras, etc. All of that has been clearly found in archaeology. Again, there are things that haven't been found. Archaeology has got to figure out what it could find and what it can't find. But pretty much we can safely say that there's no problem with archaeology versus the Tanakh. There's nothing really contradictory that you find in archaeology that contradicts what's in Tanakh. Things have to be sometimes put into proper perspective. Archaeology can help us understand certain things in Tanakh which we wouldn't have understood otherwise. I was, with this I'll finish because it's late, I was recently in Petra in Jordan, and most people go there to see the Red Rock Nabatean that's really not Jewish. I went up to Kevah Aaron HaKohen, which is way, way, way in the back over there on top. But there's also a high mountain there. And on top of that mountain is a city from the days of Edom, from the first Beis HaMikdash, on top of the mountain. And I said to the person with me, I said, you know, you look at this, you understand. Ovadia Yirmiyahu HaNavi says in the Pasuk, he says, Im Tagbia Kanesha, if you go as high and soar like eagles, Ve'im Ben Kochavim Sim Kinecho, and if you put your nest between stars, from there Hashem says, I will cast you down. No matter how high you go, I'll throw you down. I said, when you go here and you look at this city, which is on a high cliff, then you understand exactly the metaphor that Yirmiyahu said. It has a whole, Yirmiyahu and Ovadia said. It's a whole different thing when you're looking at it to understand exactly why he used such terminology, because you look at it, you see exactly where the city is situated. So as I said, archaeology can help us sometimes understand the terminology in Tanakh when we get to see the reality, it makes it clearer for us. Thank you.